Before we get started, a special thank you is in order to our friends over at Stanley Customs. Stanley Customs creates amazing custom sports figurines for all you athletes out there. Right now, our listeners will get 15% off their order, and all interviewees will get 25% off their order simply by going to Stanley_Customs on Instagram and telling them that Globally Ballin sent you. Thank you. Hey, everyone, and thank you for joining us, and welcome back to the Globally Ballin podcast. We appreciate your support and have a special interview and episode for you today. So sit back, relax, and enjoy learning about sports and opportunities around the world. Here comes the music. I gotta let you go.
He goes, I'll give you $750,000 a year to sign with us.
Without right even now, showing off.
He goes, don't even walk over to the field.
Because I had no idea that my passport was even expired.
Let me tell you, I sent out 6,000 emails.
Gentlemen, how do you use a celebrity for good? You know, up until that point, most of us, as athletes, were taught how to use the celebrity to manipulate, to get a girl, to get famous, to get whatever it is.
Had a couple guys get robbed at gunpoint, and one of them was just like, Jay, get me out.
Actually broke my neck. I was paralyzed from the waist down, and I was never supposed to walk again, much less be able to play football again.
We're hours away from kind of the nearest hospital. He ended up losing his leg over it.
You finished the game with a broken hand?
Yeah, I finished the game with...
I'm Rio 2016 silver medalist and Asian Games 2018 gold medalist.
I don't think a lot of people know the opportunities there are actually to play overseas, especially in the women's category.
There are some who would still keep their 9-to-5 jobs because the pay for being an athlete isn't enough.
Don't complain when we look like idiots abroad in these big tournaments.
What league or country gave you the best pay contract-wise?
Probably Turkey my last season.
Okay. To the Globally Ballin' podcast. This week we have a special episode. It is a double feature. So it's two different sports, actually, but the commonality between the two guests is actually location. So we're going to be looking at two different sports and situations in the same location, that location being Australia. So for our first guest, we're going to be looking at a sport we have never looked at yet. And for many of you, you probably don't know a whole lot about it. If you're based in the United States, it's not as popular here. That's no secret. It's definitely not as popular here, but it's massive worldwide, and that's cricket. So we're going to go to a cricket expert in Australia. He is the host of the Cricket Library podcast in Australia, Matt Ellis. Matt, again, is going to give us the lowdown on cricket. And of course, we're going to bring in the whole Globally Ballin twist to it and look at opportunities that are available, if there are any, the development of the sport, both in Australia and around the world, where we might see pockets of cricket, and not only around the world, but also in the United States. And hopefully this would be a great introduction into a new sport for you that you are unfamiliar with. For the second half of the episode, we have, again, a man from Australia. His name is Andrew Potter, and Andrew is a coach. He's the head coach of the Southern Sabres in the NBL 1. It's a women's team in Melbourne, Australia. So he'll be the second half of this episode, and after our first interview, I'll cut in and kind of introduce the next one. But I'll give you more information before that interview rolls up. But first, Matt Ellis, there's not a whole lot of introduction to do, just because there's a lot of interview ahead of us. So again, thank you for coming back for another episode. Thank you to our guests ahead of time here, and enjoy it. I hope we learned something together here about cricket in Australia and around the world. Enjoy. But before we do that, there's a couple of reminders I got to give you. First, the social media. You can always find Globally Ballin on Facebook.com/GloballyBallin, Instagram at Globally Ballin Official, and Twitter at Globally Ballin. In addition, you can now find us on Patreon at Patreon.com/GloballyBallin. We have a bunch of stuff on there. For as little as $2 a month, there's platforms for you. We had a request come in, or just a mention, that the music in the background during the interview was kind of throwing them off a little bit. And so they just suggested maybe revisiting that idea. And so we did. And we're like, wow, that's fair. Let's check into it. And so we asked some of our other listeners and some other people we know, and then we got one of the worst things that could happen was a mix of answers. And so we didn't really gain any ground whatsoever. So instead, what we did is decided to offer an extra opportunity on Patreon. So if the music really keeps you from focusing, there is an option on Patreon. It's the lowest tier that allows you to get all of our interviews. We call them short and sweet. There's no music. There is no ads. It's just cut and dry the way some of you want. And then for those of you that do kind of enjoy the music, soothing keeps you kind of locked in the conversation, which we've also heard, those will continue to be as they are. We might experiment with some different music in the background, but just keep in mind, if that's you, if the music really throws you off, there is a platform for it. And of course, let us know that that's you and we can continue to keep that in mind. So go ahead and check that out if you haven't already, but otherwise you can always reach us on those social media links. Continue to keep an eye out for our recent episodes. And finally, if you enjoyed the show, a rating on Apple Podcasts as well as maybe a short review is huge for us. It really is. It helps get the word out. And obviously, I'm a firm believer that this word is a word that needs to get out. So any of those things that you could do, follow us on the social media, maybe a rating, maybe a review, and check out Patreon at least. All of those things would be greatly appreciated. So thank you and enjoy the show.
Hello, Matt.
G'day, Aaron.
Hi, how are you?
Well, thanks, mate. How are you?
I'm all right. I'm glad we can connect. This is nice.
Yeah, no, it's good. Thanks for touching base.
No problem. You'll be the first one representing cricket on the show, so that'll be good.
Yeah, cool.
Yeah, so let's have you introduce who you are and what you do.
Yeah, sure. My name's Matt Ellis, and I'm the community cricket manager for Cricket New South Wales in Far West New South Wales. And basically, that involves inspiring a love of cricket from a grassroots level to people to grow the love of the game.
So let's talk about that love of the game. How big, as far as popularity, are we talking in Australia?
Oh, in cricket, we like to call ourselves Australia's favourite sport. And it's certainly the sport that I grew up watching and loving as a kid. I've got recollections of cricket being a part of my life from as long as I can remember. And you'll see cricket games happening on beaches, parks, schoolyards, that kind of thing. So certainly it's a loved game over here. And cricket's had its challenges at different times, but certainly been a massive part of my life, and hopefully the same for lots of other people in the future as well.
So when I think of, and I honestly, I'm coming in with not a lot of background at all, but if I had to guess the biggest areas where you'd find cricket, my guesses are like in India, Pakistan, Australia, New Zealand, and maybe like the West Indies. I don't know if that's accurate of kind of the top five areas, but is that what we're looking for worldwide?
England would be up there. South Africa, Australia, New Zealand, a lot of the subcontinent nations, as you mentioned. In India, cricket is absolutely massive. It's a loved game over there. And they're some of the most passionate cricket people you'll ever meet.
Do any of these areas have popular cricket and baseball, or does it seem to be one or the other?
I'm not sure about some of the other countries. I know the West Indies were a cricket powerhouse for a long time. And then basketball became a bit of a challenge to them in terms of popularity-wise. The NBA was pretty big. And then I'm not sure about baseball in the other countries. In Australia, baseball's relatively small compared to cricket, but still has some sort of a following, but certainly not to the extent in the United States and the following that baseball would have over there.
So a listener base is mostly in America here, where cricket is obviously not very big. So why don't you give us the quick basic rundown of how cricket works to see if we can figure it out? Because again, for most of us, now I watched a couple of, I think, do you call them matches? A couple of times. And I have a basic idea now. They're kind of fun. One of my favorite things is the fact that it's a big round. I mean, so it seems so much more packed. I didn't run the numbers to whether or not there's actually more people at the games or not, but it at least feels like it because you're in this whole enclosed circle, which makes everything louder, and it's really cool that way. But why don't you give us kind of the rundown on how a game would work?
Yeah, well, cricket has three main formats. So I'll if you're happy for me to run through the three main formats.
Yeah, that's fine.
So in Australia, one of our big domestic competition is the Big Bash, and the Big Bash League has eight teams or franchises that participate in what they call T20 cricket. So cricket is a team game, 11 players play on each side. Generally, you'll specialise in a particular skill set area. So the main skill sets, batting, bowling, and then wicket keeping slash fielding. So each team would generally have six guys that would be in the team to bat. They'd have a wicket keeper, and then they'd have four bowlers. And sometimes teams will opt to have what they call an all-rounder. So an all-rounder is someone who is proficient with the bat and equally proficient with the ball, or, okay, or vice versa. So in the Big Bash, they play 20 cricket, which is what they call 20 overs per side. So in a game of cricket, there's a pitch which is 20.12 metres long from stump to stump. And then there is an umpire that stands at one set of stumps, and they're adjudicating on decisions from that end. There's 11 fielders on the ground. One of those is the bowler. One is the wicket keeper, who stands behind the stumps at the other end. The bowler bowls the ball, and the batter, the aim for the bowling team or the fielding team is to get batsmen out. And there's a number of ways that you can get a batter out. One is bowling the ball and hitting the stumps, the batter hitting the ball in the air and the fielder catching it. Then there's an interesting one called leg before wicket, or LBW we call it, is when the batter is hit on the pads in front of the stumps, and the umpire believes that the ball would have gone on to hit the stumps. And there's a few little technicalities with that rule, but certainly is an interesting one. And there's a few other variations there as well.
So Matt, real quick, a couple of connections we can make with baseball for anybody listening to help them out is a bowler is what the pitcher would be.
Yeah,
and then 100%. The batter. So a couple of ways this batter can get out. There are some similarities. So hitting it in the air and one of the fielders catching it, that's exactly the same, right? Exactly the same.
Yeah, as baseball. Yeah.
The one, the interference one you're talking about, basically we can compare that to any sort of batter interference. There's a number of those that would get you out. So same kind of thing in that regard. Okay, what else?
Now some of the differences in baseball, the pitcher throws the ball overarm, whereas a bowler in cricket must bowl with a straight arm. So it's an overarm action where the elbow doesn't bend.
Okay, I didn't know if that was a technique or a rule. Okay.
No, that's an actual rule. So there's a certain amount of degrees that the elbow can actually bend, but it pretty much is, it's a straight arm to the naked eye. And in cricket, the bowlers will bowl the ball. They might bowl it so it bounces into the pitch. They might bowl it on the full. They might bowl what they call a Yorker, which aims to hit kind of the base of the stumps. One of the techniques that came into cricket, which is probably a bit of a baseball thing as well, is bowlers bowling variations, and one of those variations being the slower ball. So I know your pitchers will bowl will pitch curve balls and things like that. Yeah. So cricket bowlers will do the same. There's what we call fast bowlers, and they'll try and swing the ball, which will get the ball to move in the air. And then there's what we call spin bowlers, who bowl the ball slower and try and get the ball to hit the pitch and then spin in one direction or the other.
How fast do you think the fastest of these, the bowlers that are throwing really fast, how fast are they throwing?
So the fastest recorded is around that 100 miles an hour for you guys. So about 160 kilometers an hour. But a quick bowler in the Big Bash would be bowling sort of around that 140 kilometers an hour mark in Australian speak. So I don't know if that'd be sort of 90 to 95 miles an hour down to the batsman.
Does the ball have to bounce before, or does it just do that because they're trying to hit the I sound dumb, the things behind the batter?
Yeah, so they're trying to hit the stumps, but if the ball passes the batsman above the waist on the full, it's not a legal delivery. It's called a no ball. Okay. So they're trying to bounce the ball, and because cricket's played like on a grass pitch, often the pitch will offer different variations, different natural variations for the bowler, and the bowler will be trying to hit the pitch and get the ball to do something off the wicket as well. So often bowling into the pitch is a good strategy for the bowlers as well.
Okay. So if it's hit, then what happens in the game? Let's say, you know, it's bowled and then it's hit. Then what? How does the game unfold?
So the scoring options available to the batters is there's two batters batting at a time. One is the batter that we would call the batter who is on strike. They're the one facing the bowler.
Okay.
And then there's a batter at the non-striker's end that's at the other end.
Okay.
And the main objective of the batting team is to do what they call scoring runs. Now, in baseball, you score runs by getting players home around mm-hmm. the diamond. Mm-hmm. In cricket, we score runs by hitting the ball and the batters swapping ends. So anytime the batters can hit the ball and the batters can swap ends, they get a run, what they call a run, for each time they swap ends. So usually they'd be what we'd call a single when the batter hits the ball and they just swap ends, mm-hmm. or they might hit a two where they hit it and the batter who hit it goes up and then comes back, or a three where they hit it and they run up and back and they do that three times. The more popular way of scoring runs and what the fans love to see is what we call boundaries, which is when they hit the ball and it reaches the rope around the outside of the ground. That's the boundary for the playing field. If they hit it and it bounces and goes along the ground past that boundary rope, it's four runs automatically and they don't have to run. And the other one, which is the very most popular, and you see this in particularly in the 2020 cricket, is guys really giving the ball a good whack and it's clearing the rope and sometimes clearing the fence and ending up in the crowd or sometimes on the roof of the stand and that kind of thing. They get six runs for that. So you don't get any additional runs. So say you hit it and it goes for six and you've run a couple of runs before it goes over the rope, you still only get six runs for that shot. But that's certainly the most pleasing for the fans of the game to see that ball sailing over the rope.
Yeah. So as far as this, like what you might call a single or a two, is it they have to both successfully reach the other side, or does only one have to get there, or, you know, switch?
There's a crease on the ground. So there's a line on the ground about 1.2 meters in front of the stumps. It's a white line on the ground. And that line is there because the bowler needs to bowl from behind that line. And the batters, when they're completing a run, they need to ground their bat past that line for the run to be completed. And then they turn around and go to the other end. Okay. So those lines are at each end of the wicket.
Okay. And then, so baseball, obviously there's three outs to switch it up. What is it for cricket?
Yeah, so cricket, you have 11 players on a team and an innings is finished either when the allotment of overs is finished. So in a 20 over game, you might only have three or four batters that get out and then the 20 overs are finished. So then the innings is finished. But if you were to be bowled out, the fielding team would need to get 10 people out for the innings to change. So say they batted for 17 overs and all the batsmen were out, or 10 batsmen are out, then it's what they call the change of innings. They have an innings break and then they reverse the roles. The team that's just been batting comes out and fields and the fielding team bat. So two people batting at a time. And then, when the batters are dismissed, a new batter comes on until all 10 are dismissed.
When's an over done?
So, that's a good question. An over is an allotment of six legal deliveries. So balls that are bowled, so two ways that a ball will be considered not a legal delivery. One is what they call a wide, and that's when a batter in their normal batting stance effectively can't reach the ball to hit it. And that's a wide, and there's a penalty of one run for that, and the ball gets re-bowled. And then with a no ball, that's when a bowler either steps over that front line or bowls it above the waist of the batsman on the full. They're the two main ways for a no ball to be bowled. And again, there's a run penalty for that plus an extra ball needs to be bowled. And in 2020 cricket, and this is another exciting feature of the Big Bash, is when a bowler bowls a no ball in the Big Bash, the next ball for the batter is what we call a free hit, which means the batter cannot be dismissed on the following ball. So that makes that very exciting for the crowd as well. When the batter knows that they can't get out, you get to see some pretty crazy batting happening on those deliveries.
Here's a question. I think I understood. Are you allowed to hit it backwards? Like if you're somehow able to, are they able to hit it backwards?
Yeah, so this is interesting. So in recent times, 2020 cricket has seen the innovation of a number of different shots in the game. So when you say hitting backwards, the shot that I most think of is a shot they call the ramp shot, effectively where the batter lets the ball run up the face of the bat and basically go straight behind them down to the boundary. Another version of that prior to the ramp shot was what you'd call a leg glance, where the batter just kind of uses the pace of the ball to run it off the face of the bat down behind where the wicketkeeper would be, or sort of at 45 degrees to where the wicketkeeper is. And there's another innovative shot that's come in recently called the switch hit. And that's where a batter will face up right-handed, will change their grip in their hands and then execute a shot batting left-handed or vice versa. So that one's particularly challenging for the bowlers to bowl to a player who plays that shot really well, because they have their field set as if it's a right-handed batsman, and then for the batter to change halfway through and then hit it the other way is a magnificent skill that we're seeing executed in cricket in the modern game.
So one thing I will say for any listeners that are big in baseball and no idea about cricket, one cool thing that I have noticed just from watching is that what I like is it's the whole circle is open, right? It's not the 90 degree diamond like in baseball, which opens up the field significantly, and that curvature of the bat a little bit allows to put it in so many different areas that makes it pretty exciting.
Yeah, well, the best players are the ones that can access all 360 degrees on the ground. And there's been a few of those in recent times, just have innovated the way they bat to maximise their scoring opportunities, particularly in T20 cricket. You don't see as much of that in the longer formats of the game. So, as I mentioned, there's three formats. There's the 20-over format, there's a 50-over format, and my favourite, now this might shock people, but is Test cricket. And Test cricket is a game that actually goes for 5 consecutive days.
Yes, I know.
So it's fascinating. I love Test cricket because there's 3 outcomes that you can have in a Test match after 5 days of cricket. Or you can have a win, which is one of the teams finishing the game where, I'm just trying to explain this to people who wouldn't have watched it. So basically in a Test match, teams get 2 innings each. And so we'll just use an example. So say a team bats first, they get 400 runs and they're bowled out. And then the next team comes in and they make 350. Then the next team bats again and make 150. So they've then scored 500. So then the other team who are batting last would need to, their total runs for the game would need to go past that 550 runs for them to win the game. Mm-hmm. And for the team with the 550 runs, they would need to bowl the other team out. Now, if the other team are not bowled out, that's what we call a draw. And some of the more exciting games of Test cricket that I've watched growing up were actually draws, which where there's 9 batters out, the best bowlers from one team are bowling to the worst batters from another team, and somehow the worst batters manage to survive and not get out and get a draw for their team. And the other really rare one, and there's only been a couple of these in the history of Test cricket, is a tie. And that's when, after both innings, both teams have exactly the same amount of runs and both teams have been bowled. The team batting last have been bowled out when they've reached the exact total score of the opposition from their batting time. And there's a few intricacies in there as well. batting teams can declare. So they pretty much can bat for as long as they want, but they might decide when they've got to, say, 600 runs, yeah, 600 runs is enough. We've only got seven batters out, but we'll stop our innings because we want to start bowling now. And the other one is what they call a follow-on. So if a team is batting first and they get, say, 600 runs and then they bowl the opposition out for a low score, they can actually enforce the other team to have to bat again. So if they've got a lead of, I think it's 150 or more, they can say to the other team, "No, you guys need to bat again." So that's another little tactic that comes into Test cricket as well. But another difference is just something simple like the uniform. So in the 2020 cricket, the teams are all wearing coloured uniforms. There's a lot of fanfare, whereas the Test match cricket is considered a bit more traditional. The players all wear white uniforms. In the 2020 cricket, it's a white ball. In the Test match cricket, it's a red ball. And yeah, it's like a big game of chess, Test cricket, where it's the only game I can think of that goes for an extended period of time like that, 5 days, and you could still get to the end of it and end up with a draw. So I find it totally fascinating, but I can understand, probably for some of your American listeners there, watching a Big Bash game will give you a good taste of what cricket is like. And then once you get a bit of an understanding of the game and some of the intricacies of it, Test match cricket is utterly fascinating and really my favourite form of the game.
All right, let's talk professionals at least. So professional cricket players in Australia, do they kind of equally compare, at least when we're looking at professional athletes in the US, multi-million dollar contracts, everybody knows who they are, sponsorships like crazy, that kind of thing?
The best of the best are very well known and can attract external endorsements from cricket. Probably the biggest payday in cricket is the Indian Premier League 2020 tournament, where it's India's version of the Big Bash.
Okay.
And players can get contracted to go over there for exorbitant amounts of money to play 2020 cricket. I don't have the exact stats on how much they do get paid, but it's a real gold mine for short format cricketers to go over and have the experience of the IPL, a magnificent tournament, and to get financially rewarded for playing over there. There are definitely the financial rewards over there in the Indian Premier League.
So in theory, could an American athlete just go and play professional cricket in Australia or India or some of the big leagues?
Oh, I think there's a bit of a pathway. So there's a structured pathway. Each country would have their own representative pathways where young players get identified. They come into a pathway and then progress through the ranks, so to speak. So they come through the system. There are players that don't come through the pathway, but they work their way into places like the Big Bash from good performances in their club teams. So each state has a grade cricket competition. And in Sydney, I'll just use Sydney as an example because it's the one I know the best. So Sydney, there are 20 grade teams. Each team would have 5 grades and they'd have an under 21s team and an under 16s team. And so often players will come to a grade club in their under 16 team and then hopefully perform well in that under 16 team, start playing some lower grade cricket, then progress in, like, get some opportunities to play in their under 21 team, and then hopefully all the while progressing up the grades. And then there's first grade cricket in Sydney, and then the level above that is what they call Futures League. So that's the league below playing for your state. And then the level above that is playing for your state. And so each state would contract a certain amount of players each year to be full-time professionals at their state. And the majority of those end up getting Big Bash contracts. But sometimes there are guys that are not contracted to a state that might get picked up by a Big Bash franchise to be a part of their squad as well. So that's kind of the pathway in that regard. And then the Test match pathway is through a competition we call the Sheffield Shield in Australia, where each of the states play against each other in 4-day games. And It's called what we call first class cricket. It's the level below test cricket, and it's usually through weight of performances at that level where you start to get recognised, and where teams might like where you might start to put your name forward for higher honours.
Okay. All right. So is cricket an Olympic sport?
Unfortunately not. Cricket was in the Commonwealth Games, I think, in 1998 at Kuala Lumpur. Mm. And I think there was some talk of T20 cricket. I'm not 100% sure of where things got up to with that. But yeah, Kuala Lumpur was the last time. Australia actually won the silver medal at the Kuala Lumpur Commonwealth Games. But no, it's not been at the Olympics at this point.
So Kuala Lumpur is the last time they played. There was a kind of a global match of cricket. Is that what you're saying?
Oh, no. Interestingly, one of the most encouraging stories in world cricket recently was Australia just finished hosting the Women's World T20 competition. And there was over 86,000 fans at the Melbourne Cricket Ground.
Wow.
To watch Australia play India in the final of the Women's T20 World Cup. So there are World Cups in cricket, and both for the men's and the women's. So they have a 20-over World Cup and a 50-over World Cup. And the 50-over World Cup goes on a four-year cycle. And, yeah, the T20 World Cup is... The women's one happened in February, March this year, and the men's one's scheduled to happen later this year as well.
Who's the reigning champion as far as the last time these were played?
So in the women's, Australia won the World T20 competition. So they, in women's cricket, Australia, India and England have kind of been have contested at that level. Whereas in the men's competition, I'm just gonna have to have a look and see
no problem.
Who the last winner was. T20 World T20 cricket produces some surprises, and so often the best teams in Test cricket aren't necessarily always the best teams in the shorter formats of the game. Mm-hmm. So in the T20 World Cup, just having a look here, the winners in the last one. So the last one back in 2016, the West Indies were the champions there.
Mm.
So they're a great tournament and attract a lot of worldwide attention, particularly the Women's World Cup final in Melbourne recently. Katy Perry was the star attraction in terms of the pre-game and the post-game.
Really?
So they turned... Yeah, so... She performed pre-game and then she performed again post-game. So there was quite a lot of fanfare around that particular event, which was magnificent. And it's great to see that our elite female cricketers having the opportunity to play on that world stage.
So I pulled up something for the U.S. national cricket team.
Yeah.
I don't know much, but I want to run something by you and see what you think. So I pulled up their coaches and... The nationalities are, at least for the coaches, I think any cricket fan could guess. We have three coaches from India, one from the West Indies, one from Australia, one from New Zealand, and then there's one from Jamaica. So, like, how would a country like the United States open? I mean, we play basically every sport. I mean, we have cricket. But what do you think's holding back a country that, like the United States, that just isn't into it as much?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. Often it's sometimes just a cultural thing. So kids just grow up, and you guys, would it be true to say in your universities, there's a lot of opportunities for people to get scholarships at the big universities through playing particular sports? So your NFL players, your college basketball players, your baseball players, that kind of thing.
Oh yeah.
There's that kind of that dual purpose. So if you're good at your sport, that can then in turn lead to you having the educational opportunities. I don't know if something like that would be a factor, but certainly in places like Australia, it's just part of the fabric of what we do, and places like India as well. You'll see, you see images of India, and there's just games of cricket happening everywhere all the time. It's almost like everyone wants to play the game. So I don't know how you transfer that to a country like the United States, whether you, like, I guess my way of looking at it is you need to grow it from the grassroots up. So things like social cricket are new things over here that are happening. So there's social women's cricket competitions that are popping up that are attracting new people to playing cricket that don't already play cricket here in Australia. And there's really good junior pathway programs, entry level programs over here. It's called the Woolworths Cricket Blast, and it has a program specifically designed for 5 to 8 year olds, and it's and then it has another program specifically designed for kids in that kind of 7 to 10 year old age group. And I've got 3 kids of my own, and both my kids loved that Cricket Blast experience, where you do a whole lot of skills-based activities to learn the game, because things like bowling is quite a hard skill to learn, but if you have exposure to it when you're really young, in that kind of 5, 6, 7 years old age bracket, and get all your other motor skills of catching and spatial awareness and those kind of things that actually cross over into other sports as well, I think that would be the approach I would take, would be to try and get into the schools, get into the grassroots, and really provide a fun environment to learn what the game's about and to appreciate the game. And then in line with that, the Big Bash has been massive for us in terms of exposure as well. So the fact that the Big Bash is on in the summer school holidays over here, it's pretty much on television most nights of the week. And so the kids that are having a hit around in their front and backyards and in their schoolyards, they've got something to watch on the television, and they identify with the big names that are playing in the Big Bash.
Awesome. I think we got a good bit of cricket knowledge in. So, Matt, is there anything else you think any listeners here new to cricket should know, or anything else you think you want to add?
I think the main thing is the reason why we all play sport and we all love sport is the friendships and the camaraderie, the being part of a team. And that's something that I've really loved about cricket is I've played cricket since as long as I can remember, and the friendships and the networks that I've built through my time in cricket and the conversations I have with old teammates and things like that, they're memories that last for a lifetime. And cricket, a great way to intentionally spend time with people. And that's one of the things I love about it the most.
Awesome, Matt. Thank you. Appreciate it very much.
Yeah, and if there are any cricket fans out there listening, I do actually have a cricket specific podcast called the Cricket Library podcast.
Okay.
It's mainly long form interviews, but if you want to hear some stories of some cricketers that have played at the elite level, I have some good conversations on there that people can have a listen to. So
for sure. What was that called again?
The Cricket Library podcast.
Okay.
And it's on all the major channels, so you should be able to find it. I do have some regular listeners in the United States that come through, so hopefully some of them will have a listen to this as well.
Do you have a location as to where, does it break down where in the United States or not?
Yeah, I'll tell you. I'll just give me a sec.
Go ahead, because I'm very interested in that.
So in the last month, I had 38 downloads out of the States in the last month, 11 in Virginia, 8 in New York, 6 in Michigan, 5 in California, and 3 in Washington. Michigan pops up a lot, actually. I'll just bring up my all-time or my last 2 years.
Yeah, go ahead. I'm in Michigan, so that's interesting to me.
Yeah, so my last 2 years, 353 in New York, 181 in Michigan,
wow.
67 California, 24 Virginia, 9 Florida, 9 Ohio, 8 Missouri, 3 Georgia, 3 Indiana, 3 Pennsylvania, a couple of Minnesota, Nevada, Arizona, Delaware, Illinois, Kansas, Maine, Oregon, Texas, Utah, and Washington.
Hmm. The first couple make sense. The most populated being, you know, California, New York. Michigan is kind of an outlier in there. I'm not really sure. There's got to be a reason, so figure that out.
Yeah, I'm not really sure either. Like, I've got friends in the United States, but not at Michigan. So, yeah, that is an interesting one.
All right. I will plug that for sure because I want to have it grow, man. So thank you very much, Matt. And I'll send you a link when this is all ready, okay?
My pleasure, Aaron. Hope it all goes well for you. And if you ever need anything in the future, please let me know.
Thank you. You too.
Okay. See ya. Bye for now.
This episode is also brought to you by our friends over at Creating Young Minds. Creating Young Minds is a nonprofit out of Lewisville, Texas, brought to you by Dr. Shira Ackerman and Coach Mathis Crowder. Creating Young Minds strives to bring success to the lives of young men in ways in which they may have not reached that success otherwise. One of the ways in which they do this is through their professional basketball team, the Lewisville Yellow Jackets, who play in TBL or the Basketball League. Make sure you go check out Creating Young Minds on all major platforms, including Facebook and LinkedIn. I encourage you to dive more into the mission of Creating Young Minds as they strive to bring the European model of basketball to the United States. Thank you. All right, so that was the end of part one, the first half of our Sports in Australia episode. Interview with Matt Ellis talking cricket. I think for a lot of you, that was new stuff. You're probably well aware of how big, or the fact that cricket is huge in certain areas. It's just not big here. And that's part of the reason why I wanted to have him on, is because it's an interesting question. How can a sport that be so big in some places be virtually untouched in a very large country like the United States? It's I have pre-recorded another episode that'll be coming up in the future about baseball around the world and more of a general look, and that it kind of gives me the same feeling. Baseball is massive in the United States, and yet you'll go to other countries around the world that don't have leagues. Some of them don't even have like leagues for youth for the most part, and it's weird, if nothing else, that one sport can be so massive someplace and another part of the world that seems to feel smaller and smaller every year can be virtually completely uninterested in the sport in some regards. And so that's what I wanted to bring to the show, is a look at how that passion can differ, and kind of dissect it a little bit with Matt. But I hope you enjoyed it. I hope you learned a little bit about that. And this is going to move us on to our second half of the episode, looking at the NBL 1 League and women's basketball in Australia kind of more generally with head coach of the Southern Sabres, Andrew Potter. So enjoy this half of the episode. Thank you.
Hello.
Hi, Andrew. How are you?
Good, thanks, Aaron. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Yes, really well.
Good.
Not too bad in these strange times.
Yeah, that's weird, huh?
It is.
So what we do, Andrew, is we have an episode twice a week, and we bring in somebody from around the world that can represent and give our listeners an idea of opportunities to play sports outside of the big, well-known leagues. So outside of, if it's outside of the NBA, MLB, NHL, and NFL, you're in. And so
yep,
you'll be here for what you specialize in. So to start off, let's have you introduce who you are and what you do.
My name's Andrew Potter. I live in Melbourne, Victoria, Australia, and I'm an NBL 1 women's coach in Victoria with the Sandringham Southern Sabres.
Okay, so to start off, that's basketball, correct? Women's basketball. And so there's...
Yes, women's basketball. You go.
Okay, and so there's an NBL 1. Is there different levels of the NBL for women?
Within our structure, there is a WNBL and an NBL. The NBL catches a little bit of notoriety. Mm-hmm. We had like Mello Ball out here last year and RJ Hampson. The WNBL is the women's side of it. We have a number of American imports that come over, mainly WNBA rookies or on their rookie contract. Kia Nurse won the MVP last year in the WNBL, and in fact won the premiership with the Canberra Capitals. Outside that, the next level down is the NBL 1, which is more of a state league-based competition that's run in Queensland, New South Wales, Victoria and South Australia at the moment. This is new. This would have been the second year that this competition has played. It took over from a competition called the Seabull league. So we get a lot of WNBL players who come and play for us who don't want to go overseas or don't get an overseas contract, to keep them going and circulating until they can go back to the NBL, WNBL. Below us in Victoria, there is the Big V competition, which has a Premier League, and then two or three divisions under that, including youth league opportunities, so that there's a clear pathway for players coming through their associations to be able to make the NBL 1 or WNBL, or in fact, a lot of them go to college over in the States before they start their professional career.
So you have this NBL 1. I assume then the time frame of the schedule kind of sits in the off season of the WNBL to keep people around, or the people that aren't getting contracts overseas are staying. Is that what you're saying? So are you playing during that off season?
Yes. So our WNBL finishes in early February, and then the NBL 1 normally starts late March, early April. It kind of depends a little bit on when Easter occurs, but also depends on when the next WNBL season starts. And so NBL 1 normally finishes early August. I think with the expanding nature of NBL 1, there would have been a state versus state NBL 1 competition to finish off the season to get an Australian NBL 1 championship. Last year, they also put together like an all-star team that travelled to some Asian competitions, played some warm-up games for the WNBL girls to help keep the product going.
Is the NBL 1 directly associated with WNBL, or are they independent from each other?
No, the WNBL is completely independent. The NBL 1 is more run out of the NBL 1 side of things. So the WNBL is run through Basketball Australia, whereas the NBL is run through a private company and has a private owner who came in a few years ago to save the league. And his organisation has certainly done a great job, and they've taken the NBL 1 under their wing because they want to have opportunities for basketball pipeline for up and coming players to come into the NBL, but also into the WNBL, because they may have been development players. So they wanted to keep, when Basketball Australia didn't want to keep that next level, they wanted to keep that happening. And to keep more players having opportunities to stay in Australia in that off-season.
So does the NBL 1 bring in foreign players as well, or does it typically work on those pipeline players from inside Australia?
So that's a club-by-club decision. Most clubs bring in two imports, whether they're all from America, they tend to be. But some clubs, like my own, in fact, have a no import policy and want to continue to develop the local rather than bring in some imports. But that doesn't, and that's a club by club decision. There's a couple of clubs like that, but most do bring in imports into the mix.
So your club not bringing in imports, do you find yourself lacking sometimes against the teams that can bring in the imports, or can the local talent keep up with some of those imports from around the world?
It's a pretty competitive market during the recruiting phase. I think that we certainly found last season not going with some imports to fill in the gaps made it a tough year. Also with some college players coming back meant that we missed them at the start of the season, so there are a number of issues there. But this year we certainly addressed some of those. But we certainly, as far as the local talent goes, there is a very small number of big fives, the big centre, and quite often the import role bring in that big monster of a centre who can monster us. Because we just don't have that local talent available to match them, even if we're able to recruit the pick of the Australian bigs from Victoria. So that certainly is an issue. So it certainly challenges defensive structures and things like that. But also we recruited slightly differently this year, so that we could do some of those types of things. But that can be an issue.
So obviously this podcast helps athletes understand their opportunities, and one of the big opportunities is the money that they can bring in. So it, not specific, but what's a fairly average number you think somebody in the NBL 1 could expect as an import coming over to play?
So generally speaking, they can get around the $20,000 Australian dollar mark, plus there are opportunities to add to that through working at basketball camps, doing clinics and things like that outside that the club will organise and or Basketball Victoria will organise, and use those players because they're draw cards for the younger kids to come to camps and get to know them and things like that. Quite often, as well as their base wage, airfares are taken care of, and then obviously accommodation and vehicles are taken care of on top of their paid wage. So it does get more pricey for some associations. And there's in Victoria, there's 18 teams, and there's two teams that come out of Tasmania to make it a 20-team competition. So there are great opportunities within Victoria for international players to come over and play, for sure.
And so is that $20,000 a month or is that a year?
No, that's for the length of the season. So the season would normally be a 5-month, 6-month situation. So yeah, but that's why the camps become a little bit important, but also the potential to show their wares at that level, that then they may get picked up for the WNBL, which has bigger budgets. Mm-hmm. But with the airfares, with their transport and their accommodation sort of taken care of, there are other little deals that are done with players. We don't have a salary cap per se, and so some of the, I guess you would call, boosters within the club, you know, might throw a little bit more at them that are
sure. That
aren't part of mine as the head coach's area of expertise, but you know, they only have to pay for those consumables, I guess, like some food and petrol and things like that to get around.
On an average game in NBL 1, what would be your rough estimate about how many people fan-wise come into the watch?
So since we've gone to the NBL 1 model, we had a significant increase in spectator, but also every game was live streamed. And so people who couldn't get to games were able to jump on, particularly teams from like Tasmania, so that's another state in near Victoria. We have a number of country teams that have to travel maybe 4 hours to get to, and so our local supporters were able to watch games on the live stream, and that really increased. So we probably get between some venues, particularly the country venues, probably have upwards of a couple of thousand, 1,500 to 2,000 spectators. My home association was probably more in the 600 to 1,000 range.
How does that compare with the WNBL?
So the WNBL is probably more in the 3,500 to 5,000, depending on the team and the venue. I guess we try and work the venues a little bit smaller so that they're fuller, mm-hmm. and the atmosphere is a lot better. But in that sort of 3,500 to 5,000 people. So yeah, probably a small college type situation, sure. as far as you guys are concerned.
How, looking at Australia as a whole, where does basketball stand on the scale of popularity when it comes to sports?
It is ranked either 1 or 2 as far as popularity goes. To give you an example, a Friday night in Victoria, there could be upwards of 20,000 plus junior players playing in their representative competition each and every Friday night from 6 o'clock till 11 o'clock at night, across all the associations. So it is huge, and we're really talking about the pointy end of the pyramid as far as that goes, up at the WNBL and NBL 1 level. But they're all pathways for our juniors. Our Opals, our senior women's team, are ranked, I think at the moment, number 2 in the world. Our junior teams have been winning gold medals and medals consistently over the last 10, 15 years or so. And so this all helps build basketball as a sport. Being a club-based sport here in Australia, it's been surprising also the number of schools that now offer basketball programs within their school curriculums to attract students and help develop students. So there are a lot more pathways and opportunities for players to get better and get that regular practice, as well as the elite programs that places like Basketball Victoria run to help develop our juniors.
So is playing basketball in Australia as an import, is that a place you see imports continuing to come back to because they want to continue playing there? Or is it maybe a season here and then going somewhere else?
No, it tends to be that imports keep coming back. I think the fact that we're similar in structure and nature to America, you know, we speak the same language. The lifestyle's pretty good out here. The people are very friendly and supportive and really take those people to heart. You get the same imports returning year after year and or into other leagues within the Australian context, if not Victoria. Occasionally, I guess, some of them get picked up by better clubs in Europe and things like that, or back into the WNBA, and that makes it harder for them to come back later on. But no, we get a lot of the same imports coming back regularly. And, you know, to take a longer example, you know, the Ben Simmons of the world, his dad was an import playing in the NBL and he stayed. Dante Exum's dad stayed, and there are examples of that in the WNBL structure of things as well, that imports will stay and you know, live their life here, and now their children are starting to come through different programs as well, which is really exciting as well.
Yeah, we just did an interview with Josh Boone, who played there a couple of years and returned
So he was in Melbourne with Melbourne United and then went up to Illawarra last season. So yeah, it was great to see him.
Yeah, he loved it. So I would assume that basketball or playing basketball in Australia as an import, like you, I think you alluded to, I wouldn't be surprised just to see their life turn into being in Australia, you know, continuing to go back. And then before you know it, you're just there long term.
Yeah, it is that sort of pretty good climate, pretty good lifestyle, and yeah, very friendly people, and it can become a way of life that a lot of people enjoy, you know, and they enjoy coming back because of the reception and the individual following that they build up and things like that. And so, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, a Mercedes Russell, who had a really good first season down here with one of the WNBL team, I wouldn't be surprised to see her back. Leilani Mitchell became naturalized and now plays for the Opals, as well as playing locally, and I think she's just been traded in the WNBA. So, you know, there is that pathway, and, you know, I think, you know, it's not a bad place to grow up and live and develop a family and that type of thing, maybe away from their home, their natural home.
So if a player, like you said, it's kind of that development, the NBL one, getting a chance to continue to play and maybe make it up to WNBL, is that growth and ability to move on up the same for imports as well? So if an import comes into the NBL one, they have that same possibility of kind of moving up to the WNBL?
Yeah, I think that there is certainly that pathway there. They probably have to work a little bit harder to not get noticed, but then, you know, a lot of the WNBL imports these days are coming from the WNBA on the rookie sort of their first contract side of things. But that being said, you know, we also lose some of our local Australian players who don't come back and play WNBL. Liz Cambidge hasn't played for a couple of years now. Beck Allen hasn't come back. They prefer to go and play in China or Europe, where they can make a little bit more money while they're at that level. But that's not to say that each team doesn't look at having, you know, whether they're backup imports to their imports, part of their development program within the WNBL, and they do look more locally for that to occur.
So that makes sense, looking locally for that. But when it comes to being an athlete in, we'll take all three of these leagues here for a second, the men NBL, the WNBL, and the NBL one, are the players known off of the court? Would you consider them celebrities in each one of these leagues, or maybe not for all of them?
So in the area that they they live and work for basketball, they do become very well known. Sometimes their previous profile from wherever they've been adds to that. David Barlow, who plays for Melbourne United, plays for Sandringham in the off season. He was a local junior. He played overseas. He's played for Australia. He comes back and plays in our NBL 1 men's team these days, and he's exceedingly well known and always stops for autographs or chats with kids and things like that. So there's great transfer across the public, and you know, they have the opportunity of getting up close and personal at NBL 1 level, and so it sort of builds and enhances their. We had a family last year who would travel probably an hour 15 minutes to come to all our home games because they knew two of our players and just wanted to see them and follow them and support them. And so we'd get them to sit behind our bench occasionally, or they'd just sit up in the stands so that they could come and watch two of our senior, you know, players and things like that. And so, you know, they do become heroes to the kids. And that's where those camps and that local clinics and things like that really help with that.
I assume that level of recognition is the same for the imports, or maybe even a little higher?
Yeah, probably a little bit higher. They get a little bit more of the publicity, depending on who else is in the team. But also they tend to be around the club a little bit more, helping with the early morning clinics or the camps, their first cabs off the rank. As far as that goes, but also their level of experience and expertise helps sell them, and that's why we pick them up in as imports and things like that. And so they get out to the schools and do clinics to help lift our brand and our team as well, and things like that. And so, yeah, so finding that right person who's up for that sort of thing is part of the process as well.
All right, let's wrap it up here. Let's assume somebody's listening and has some offers on the table to play, and one of them is playing basketball in Australia. What would be your pitch to them as to why they should seriously consider, assuming some of the main things are the same, maybe money is the same in all these offers? Outside of that, what's some of your big pitches for why they should come play in Australia?
I think that on the basketball side, we're a very progressive league. We develop with world trends. And that can be seen by the way the coaches here have developed and how we do internationally, whether it's on tours with their own teams over around the world, or how the Australian girls in junior level and senior levels develop. Finding, obviously, you know, as we see in colleges all the time, finding the right coach with the right sort of system is more important to how the player will eventually develop and enjoy their time. And so understanding how that coach plays, the types of structures and things like that. We tend to be a very up-tempo, full court type of game. And so if that suits, that's not to say that in the half court, we don't try and pound the ball inside and things like that. And so I think that's the most important thing. They'll get an understanding that the area that they come into, whether it's a country association or a metropolitan in the main city association, will take to them and enjoy having them if they're willing to put themselves out there and enjoy their experience. If they're super introverted or just worrying about their basketball and sort of hide on the sidelines, then it might become a little bit tougher. All the teams that we have, you know, have really good cultures that the coaches build in, and so the team function really well, and that's certainly a big part of, you know, making them feel welcome and happy and all that sort of thing. So I think those three areas are probably the key.
Finally, Andrew, anything you think you'd like to add that we haven't talked about to kind of help illustrate NBL 1, or anything you think we missed that we should quick talk about?
I think that NBL 1, although it's a second tier competition to the WNBL, we have Australian players, we have Australian junior players, we have international players coming out
been playing, and the standard is of a high level. That's shown by the way the All-Star groups played against international teams at the end of the year. So it might be a foot in the door that an import can then exploit to their advantage and, you know, start making more money both here in Australia and or overseas, having had a successful professional introduction, as it were, out of college. Certainly there's more and more Australians over in college in America that can give you an idea of, you know, the type of people we are and how we play and things like that. And I think that all just helps build the package.
Absolutely. All right, Andrew, thank you very much for all of that. I appreciate you taking some time. Stay healthy and stay safe, and I'll send you a link to this when this is all set, okay?
Good on you, mate. Thank you, Aaron. I appreciated the opportunity. Have a great day.
You too. Thanks.
Cheers. Bye.
I hope you enjoyed that half with Mr. Potter, as well as kind of the whole episode in general. One of the main things I want to close with and hear back from you is, what do you think about kind of the double feature idea? As long as they're related, obviously these were related geographically, two completely different sports, but at least geographically they kind of mesh together. So I want to hear what you think about that, if that's something we do. We do have some more. We do pre-record some of these, depending on kind of the time we have and how schedules work up for interviews. But so that being said, we do have a couple more of these double features coming up. And if you like them, let us know. We're going to do our very best. I mean, we're going to make them related for sure. But let us know what you think about that idea of kind of having the double feature. Do you enjoy it? Do you think it's better that way? It keeps me from talking too much, which is great. I don't have a whole lot to wrap up on, except for Matt's interview. One thing I did when kind of getting into the whole spirit of this is I sat down and watched some of these cricket matches, and they're really fun to watch. I'm a big proponent of, if the crowd's into it, I can be into it. That's why, you know, high school basketball games can still be really fun, even though they're not the best players in the area. It's just high schoolers. But if you go to the right atmosphere and it's packed and fans are screaming, it's fun to be there. I'm a big proponent of that, and cricket can be the same way. You might not understand what's going on, but to see the crowd go absolutely nuts for certain situations, it can be a fun thing to watch and easier to get into that way if it kind of reels you in. When it comes to the interview with Andrew, one part I loved was that quick little tidbit talking about how their lives might kind of morph into living more in Australia. This is something that we see from time to time. Athletes that go on overseas somewhere and they'll bounce around, and there's certain pockets that might reel them in more long term. And so if you're seeing that, if you're seeing players go play in Australia for whatever sport and then staying there longer, obviously, that's a really good sign for not only the league and the opportunities, but the country as a whole. If the country's terrible, if it's terrible climate, if it's, you know, nobody likes the food, whatever, dangerous for whatever reason, if it's any of that, athletes won't want to make their lives over there. But when Australia is able to reel athletes in after they've played and continue to bring them back and even keep them after they've played to kind of start their life in Australia, that speaks volumes to everything, all the amenities of Australia outside of the leagues itself. And you as an athlete, that's something you'll definitely want to consider, is not necessarily just how much am I getting paid, but what's the country like? And that's one thing we've always tried to bring to you. And I think that little kind of piece with Andrew is important to show that. And so again, thank you all for listening. Thank you to our guests, both Matt and Andrew. Let us know what you think about the double feature. Thank you all for your support, and you'll hear back from us next Wednesday. Hey everybody, thank you again for getting through another episode. We really appreciate it. I just want to quick redirect you to where you can find us one more time to kind of close out this whole episode. You can find us at facebook.com/globallyballin, Twitter @globallyballin, Instagram @globallyballinofficial. The name was taken. And patreon.com/globallyballin. Again, what you can find there is all of these episodes music free, as well as ad free, and a bunch of other tiers that offer you a lot of other stuff. There is a ton of content available for you that you are not getting here, that's out there on the Patreon page. So if you want to check that out, that would be great. And then of course, again, if you like the show, we would really appreciate a rating and a review wherever you listen. I know I normally suggest Apple Podcasts, but if there's a way, you know, if you listen to it somewhere else and there's a way to rate it, that would be great as well. But any of that is very, very helpful and very much appreciated. It does take a lot of work putting these things together and editing them up and making it all mesh together and getting our interviews lined up and all this. So it takes a lot, but we really believe in it, and we encourage you, if you believe in it too, doing one of those things to help us out would be fantastic. Otherwise, simply you listening to our episodes coming out is a huge blessing to us. So thank you very much for supporting the show, and you'll get an episode from us here in the coming days.